I was asked to talk about presidential power, the war on terrorism, and the loss of freedom. And I don't want to address the question of presidential power or any of these things in a vacuum. I want to address whatever I talk about tonight in the context of the notion that there really is no war on terrorism, that war on terrorism has got nothing to do with anything, except as a cover for what the government is doing both at home and abroad. And that's, if there's one theme in my remarks, I guess it's that, and then what we can do about all of that. I suppose the way to ask the question is, if the war on terrorism and presidential actions post 9/11 do not make us safer, then why is the U.S. government doing these things? And it's my contention that they don't make us safer, and I will talk about that a bit tonight. But first, presidential power. There are, of course, at least two aspects of presidential power that, and the abuse thereof, that we're all pretty familiar with. First of all, of course, you've got the fact that the president can today, for all practical purposes, declare war without benefit of Congress. That's a rather major development in the history of the development of presidential power. Oh, the Congress then does something to kind of authorize after the fact what he's doing, but in point of fact, the president seems to have the power to declare war now, despite what the Constitution says. And then, of course, first he declares war on his own say-so, and then he further usurps the Constitution by then engaging in acts, like the NSA spying, that he wouldn't dare to admit that he's engaged in if it were, quote-unquote, peacetime. But now, of course, that we're at war, anything goes. But there's a third aspect of the development of presidential power in our lifetime, certainly, and represents a power grab that we talk about less. Came up during the confirmation hearings recently in the Supreme Court, confirmation hearings, right? This whole notion of the unitary executive, this whole notion of presidential signing statements. And they're really not all that complex to understand. And up until Reagan, almost no one ever used them. I mean, I don't think there have been 100 of them in the history of the United States before Ronald Reagan, yet he didn't use many of them. They are simply announcements made by the president at the time that he's signing a bill, and what he's reading, these signing statements, have generally been prepared for him, or any president, by the Justice Department. And they provide the president's interpretation of the language of a particular law that he's in the midst of signing. These statements, of course, tend to delimit from the president's point of view, what this law really means and what provisions he thinks are cricket and which ones aren't. As I say, presidents tend to issue such statements when they do not like but are not prepared to veto legislation that they are signing in. Somebody pointed out that if Bush now vetoes the supplemental appropriation bill, it'll be his first emergency funding bill, it'll be his first veto. Well, that may have something to do with the fact that in his first term, he issued over 400 signing statements. And the number is now, I don't know what the number is now, it's way up there, 750. In issuing these statements, of course, he has referred to this concept of the unitary executive no less than 95 times. And the unitary executive theory is associated with that conservative thought that argues that the powers of Congress to divest the president of control of the executive branch is very limited. All right, well, let's take a look at it for a minute. One of the great dangers, of course, obvious dangers flowing from these signing statements is that a conservative Supreme Court will tend to treat them in the same way that courts have traditionally treated legislative history. Well, on the one hand, we've got the legislative history. They thought they were doing X, Y, and Z when they passed this law. And on the other hand, we've got the president who issued a signing statement, and he thought the law meant X, Y, and Z when he signed it. Well, that would be fine if the president, of course, had legislative power, but he doesn't. The president really, if you think about it, does have three kinds of power under the Constitution, but none of them are this. First, he has the power to veto a bill. Second, he has the authority to see that the laws that are passed by Congress are faithfully executed, quite different than legislating. And third, he has the power to propose legislation. But none of these express or implied powers, of course, justify a presidential role in creating authoritative legislative history. In short, the power to execute the laws of the land does not include the power to interpret the laws of the land. And I would suggest Congress, of course, needs to start asking why the president feels he can do this. But the Congress has not yet really done that. Some questions were raised, as I say, during the confirmation hearings, but Congress seems to be prepared to roll over almost anything these days. Now, as I said, the president argues he needs these expanded powers. Whether it's extra spying, whether it's the Patriot Act, whatever it is, all these extra, these powers, legislative curbs on civil liberties, because we're at war, he says, and we're at war with a very different kind of enemy than we've ever encountered before. Indeed, the Bush administration claims that the reason it went to war in Iraq changes day by day, but the overarching reason has something to do with the war on terrorism. Never mind that the terrorists came from Saudi Arabia and not from Afghanistan. We'll bomb Afghanistan. Never mind that there were no terrorists in Iraq. We're going to bomb Iraq in order to make us safe from the weapons of mass destruction, whether they have them or not, because it's a war on terrorism. And of course, when he does this, at the same time, because of the natural fear that grips a country when it's been attacked, and we're not used to being attacked. We were talking before about Pearl Harbor and wondering why the U.S. thought it owned the Hawaiian Islands anyway, but that's a topic for another day. But we've not been attacked on our continental shores, and now we have. But people are frightened. Politicians play into that fear. And so there's not only an international war on terrorism, so-called, but there's also a domestic war on terrorism, is there not? And that's what Patriot Acts and all of that have to do with, you see, and secret wiretappings and all the rest. In light of this, it seems to me it's only fair that we, the American people, ask, as I say, whether or not these repressive laws and measures and the wars overseas are making the American people safer. In fact, whether what's being done really has anything to do with fighting terrorism. So let's look at the record of this government in terms of making us safer post 9/11. That's one way of seeing what it's all really about. Since 9/11, for example, 80,000 Arabs have been required, right, to register with the government. 8,000 more Arabs were called in by the FBI for these more intensive interviews. And more than 5,000 were locked up in preventative detention without access to lawyers and all the rest. And yet, not one of these 93,000 people stands convicted today of a terrorist crime. In short, despite the government's massive government campaign of ethnic profiling, the government is zero for 93,000 at-bats. Now, roundups of people unrelated to these 93,000, the Bush administration claims that it's gotten over 200 convictions in other terrorism cases, and that it has identified and interrupted al-Qaeda cells in Buffalo, my hometown of Detroit, Seattle, Portland, Oregon, and Virginia. But when pressed by the media, it was forced to admit that not one of those groups, supposedly identified as a terrorist group, were in fact al-Qaeda cells or anything like it. And as the Washington Post pointed out, only 39 of those 200 quote-unquote terrorist convictions involved charges that even related to terrorism. The rest were for overstaying a visa or similar immigration violations having nothing to do with violence or terrorism. And in fact, if you look more closely, even in the case of those 39 cases where people were convicted of terrorism, none of them were actually charged with any act of violence or act of terrorism, but simply with giving support to a terrorist group. In one such case, and it gives you some idea what we're up against, still pending in court, a human rights group is being prosecuted because it offered human rights training to a Turkish organization, even though the government admits that the intent of the training was to discourage terrorism and encourage a peaceful resolution of disputes. Nevertheless, because that group is on a list somewhere of being a terrorist group, to go and try to convince that group to not be a terrorist group and to resolve its differences with people in a peaceful way gets you, and still dragging on, in federal court. This case highlights one of the most draconian aspects of the Patriot Act, the fact that it changes the definition of terrorism. You know, before 9/11, you could send $100 over to some charity, a charity in Lebanon or somewhere, and assume that would be the end of it. Not now. You better be very careful. Could be the charge now of providing material support for terrorism. And just ask the dozens of people who have written those kinds of checks post 9/11 and have found themselves, in some cases, grabbed from another country, even though they were American citizens, and brought back here for trial. Are we safer, though? That's the question at the moment we're looking at. As Professor David Cole has written in the New York Review of Books, and I quote, in 2004, the State Department reported that terrorist incidents throughout the world had dropped in the previous year, a fact that Deputy Secretary of State Richard L. Armitage promptly cited as clear evidence that we are prevailing in the fight against terrorism. But 2 months later, Cole points out, a chagrined Colin Powell acknowledged that the department had miscounted, and that in fact terrorism worldwide had increased. In fact, such attacks, I guess you can really miscount when you want to, in fact, such attacks had increased threefold from 2003 levels. You know, in a dangerous world, there are things we can and must do, whether there's terrorism. You know, first of all, a war, what is a war on terrorism? It's a war on a tactic. It's like, say, we have a war on a tank. We have a war on guerrilla warfare. We have a war on B-52 bombers. What does that mean? But certainly there are things you want to try to do and make yourself safer. We could try to keep the weapons that the so-called terrorists are using out of their hands instead of being the biggest supplier of weapons in the world. We could spend the money to police our ports instead of allowing the vast majority of containers that enter the U.S. not to even have a peek inside. And you know that emergency funding bill that Bush just sent to the Congress didn't include in it one penny for enhanced port security, even though everybody in the country knows that stuff can come into our ports and nobody is the wiser. And of course, we could address the many just grievances that drive people to extreme violence in the first place. For example, the poverty which we help create by our decades of exploiting and expropriating for ourselves the resources of much of the rest of the world, or the support we give to so many of the world's most ruthless and corrupt undemocratic rulers, our willingness to criticize the Palestinians but never seem to want to criticize the Israelis, and now our action in actually wanting to visit collective punishment upon the Palestinian people because they have the audacity, some of them, to vote for somebody we don't like in a democratic election. So that may have something to do with why they don't like us, as opposed to Bush's explanation that they hate our freedom. So if the U.S. Patriot Act and ethnic profiling and presidential spying really do little to prevent acts of terrorism on our shores, then why are George Bush and company so determined to keep pushing and expanding such repressive measures? Well, I firmly believe that the real reason why George Bush and company wanted the Patriot Act in the first place was not because they wanted to keep Americans safe from terrorists, or even to fight the so-called war on terrorism, but because they wanted to protect themselves from the people of this country who might dare to protest their wars based on lies. In short, not to protect us from terrorists, but to protect Bush and company from we, the American people, in the face of the imperial designs of the ruling elite in this country. Now, that sounds pretty highfalutin. What do I mean by the imperial designs of the ruling elite? Noam Chomsky, writing in the Monthly Review, sums it up better than I ever could. And here's what he says about the U.S. drive for world domination. First, he points out that there was a study. This is all, you can all go look at this online now, actually, and you should do so. There was a study between 1939 and 1945 by the State Department and the Council of Foreign Relations. It met for a six-year period. And it addressed, it was called the War and Peace Studies Program. You'll note as I begin to tell you about it, peace doesn't seem to have much to do with it. And it addressed the question, you find this there if you went and looked at it, how do we organize the world? That was the question they were asking themselves as the Second World War was coming. How do we organize the world? And Chomsky says of this plan, and I quote, they drew up a concept known as grand area planning, where the grand area, capitalized, is defined as the area which, in their terms, was, and again he's quoting from them, strategically necessary for world control. The War and Peace Program determined that the minimum area strategically necessary for world control included the entire Western Hemisphere, the former British Empire, which they were in the process of dismantling, and the Far East. That was the minimum, and the maximum was the universe. Somewhere between the two came the concept of the grand area and the task of how to organize it in terms of financial institutions and planning. This, concludes Chomsky, is the framework that's remained constant throughout the post-war period, close quote. So if you look at it, he's right. For the last 60 years, at least, what U.S. foreign policy has been about is empire building. And you can't build an empire without spilling blood from time to time. And just think of how much blood has been spilled on behalf of the U.S. empire over the last 60 years. And for your empire to expand and grow, you must conquer new markets and subdue and exploit labor forces around the world and have the world's biggest nuclear arsenal. And first and foremost, you must have oil to keep it all humming along. And you must also have, you study empires over the centuries, you must also have, and it's as important as any of it, the subservience, the passive acceptance of the people living in your empire. You know, you got enough trouble with the rest of the world. It's not happy with what you're doing. The last thing you need is trouble at home. In 1999, 2 years before 9/11, Richard Perle and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and others drafted a document, we all know about it now, called the Project for the New American Century. And remember, according to this document, what America needed to be able to carry out its plan for the new American century was, and I quote, some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like Pearl Harbor. And right after the attacks of 9/11, now Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice admitted to award-winning journalist Nicholas Lehman that she had called together senior members of the National Security Council to ask them, and again I quote, think about how do you capitalize on these opportunities, close quote, which she compared to, quote unquote, those of 1945. Now, I suspect those who lost loved ones in the World Trade Center might take issue with her notion that this was an opportunity to be capitalized, but it was, if what you have in mind is expanding your empire. Think of what it's done to those who want to expand empire, and that's what we're really talking about tonight. Also remember what Defense Secretary Rumsfeld wrote upon hearing of the attacks on the Trade Center and the Pentagon. He wrote that he wanted, again, I quote, best info fast, judge whether good enough to hit Saddam Hussein at the same time. Not only Osama bin Laden, go massive, sweep it all up. Things related and not, he says. Got an opportunity, you don't want to let any part of it get away from you. In short, 9/11 was just, in their terms, the opportunity that Bush and company have been waiting for to launch a permanent global war for empire and disguise it as a war to defend the safety of the American people from these terrorists. So all of this raises what is perhaps then the most important question that we should be addressing tonight, I think. And that is, what are we rank and file members of this society to do to protect our freedoms and to end this false and counterproductive war on terrorism? What are we to do about Patriot Acts and Departments of Homeland Security and wars for empire and presidents who think they can violate the laws of Congress and tap our phone calls? Well, it's an election year. An awful lot of people are going to look to the electoral process for salvation. I'm not one of them. But a lot of people are going to do that. Certainly, we should let our members of Congress know how we think so far of their rather spineless defense of our freedom so far. Certainly, I guess we should use all avenues available to us, no matter how unreliable or unpromising. What about the courts? You know, it's getting tougher and tougher, I can tell you. Somebody who follows this, getting tougher and tougher in the courts. The right wing has had success in the courts. And in a time of war, and if we're at a time of permanent war, and Cheney and Rumsfeld, you know, they talk about this as going on for decades. Cheney refers to it as the new normalcy. He loves to call it the new normalcy, you see. And why not? So from their point of view, this is good. So we want to, you know, certainly use all avenues available to us. But I firmly believe that if that's all we do, if we keep on hoping for some candidate to do something good or enough of them to get elected somehow despite their lack of corporate dollars, and enough courts somehow to be responsive and remember there's a constitution, I think we're doomed. I firmly believe that if that's all we'll do, we will continue to lose our freedoms, and very soon that deepening repression that's settling over the land is going to be complete. It's going to become full-blown. You know, we know this. When repression comes to any country, the history of the world, it doesn't tend to come as a rule with one fell swoop. Well, sometimes, but not often if you read your history. More often it tends to come incrementally, right? And at first only its earliest victims notice that it's arriving. In this case, tens of thousands of Muslim men and women in this country, or immigrants being rounded up at the airport. And what's that?
Jews.
Well, I'm saying in this country, yeah, Jews in Germany. But then one day, if we're not paying attention, you know, it becomes complete. And we're all find ourselves in that new normalcy that Cheney likes to speak about. So the question is then, as I say, what is the single most important thing that we can do to prevent this? And you know, when I say this, I was talking to somebody the other night and they asked me, well, how bad really is this? And there was the McCarthy era, remember, Jim, and there were the Palmer raids of the 1919. Is this really, you know, qualitatively different than any other period in American history? I think so. More importantly, friends of mine who've been at this longer than I have, there are people older than me, and they've been at this much longer than I have, and who in some cases were jailed in the McCarthy period for their beliefs and so forth, believe this is the most dangerous time in their life in terms of freedom and repression in this country. Part of it has to do with the fact that it's a unipolar world in terms of who's going to say no to Uncle Sam, but there are other reasons as well. So what do we do to prevent this full-blown repression? I think the answer may disappoint you in its simplicity, but I think that its simplicity is misleading. I think the single most important thing we can do is what we're doing tonight. It's simply to speak up, to refuse to be silent, to refuse to be quieted by. You can't imagine, you folks don't fall into that category. You can't imagine how many people today desist from going to an anti-war demonstration because they know their license plate is going to be photographed. They know their boss may not approve of it. They understand that Big Brother is watching in a way unlike the way he's always been watching. They understand it. They feel it. It has a chilling effect on people. People sometimes ask, where's the anti-war movement? Well, we can talk about that. I think it's actually way ahead of it was during Vietnam. One of the most dramatic things was to see what happened with the immigrant rights movement when a bill was put into Congress to criminalize all of those folks. Without hesitation, they took to the streets by the millions. Undocumented, more to lose than us. It might be well to look at what that's about and why folks who are newer to this country than some of us who've been here for a while seem to have more courage when it comes to standing up for our rights than some of the rank and file members of this society who have been here for generations. But whatever it is, it's more than anything else speaking up. It's you and me and hopefully millions of others doing it, of course, refusing to be intimidated by Patriot Acts. It's you and me and others speaking out against repression, not just policies we may disapprove of when it comes to the repression itself, but policies of the government. One of the beauties, one of the reasons why the Bush administration and the quote-unquote ruling elite likes the war on terrorism is because if it's a war that goes on forever, while we're at war, they can argue all sorts of other things should be granted to the ruling class, right? Give me an example. CAFTA, the free trade bill, was failing by a couple of votes in the Congress of the United States after 9/11. Dennis Hastert walks into the House and he says, "We're at war. How can you possibly deny the president the fast-track authority he needs to negotiate economic treaties with Latin America? We're at war." Two or three votes change just like that. Just like that. When you're at war, you know. So it's a way to affect domestic policy, too. It's a way to try to quell protest around global justice issues. It's a way to try to deal with Social Security, abortion rights, all sorts of other issues that if you're at war, maybe you've got to be willing to sacrifice a little bit on. That's been the history of this country, or any country, when it's at war. So I salute all those tens of thousands of people who continue to march against the war. 300,000 of them, they say, in New York on April 29th, organized by a lot of the labor groups in New York. Wonderful. At a time when most of us and most of the world was focused on the immigrant rights issue, and rightly so, 300,000 people didn't get much attention in the press. That's the answer. Think about it this way, maybe. Vietnam, let's take Vietnam as an example of what I'm trying to talk about. The Vietnam War ended under who? Nixon and Ford, right? Were they men of peace? Why did it end under Nixon and Ford if they're not men of peace? It ended under Nixon and Ford because the victories on the battlefield by the Vietnamese liberation forces, coupled with the movement here in the United States, which had finally reached into every nook and cranny of the country, including in the military itself, made it impossible for any president or any Congress, be they Democrat, Republican, war, or hawk, to continue that war. Which should remind us of what I've been trying to say earlier, I guess, tonight, that to me the most important question, even in an election year, is not who is sitting in the White House or who's sitting in the Congress even, but who is marching in the streets of America. If you want to talk about the civil rights movement, talk about the women's movement. Do you think those 9 men on the Supreme Court woke up in 1974 and they said, "Ugh, have we been wrong? Where was our head? Of course a woman has a right to choose." Or did it have something to do with the fact that hundreds of thousands of women and their supporters had been marching in the streets for years demanding no less than that right? And you can do the same thing around voting rights issues, around civil rights issues. Yes, finally Congress signs off on the will of the people, but it doesn't work the other way around. So I stress this so much, I suppose, tonight is because one of my greatest fears always is in election year especially, that the emphasis to direct the energy into speaking your mind, not compromising with your views, not signing on to some campaign because somebody's a little less evil than somebody else, not believing that the politicians will bail us out of the mess that we're in, when after all, you know, look at what the Democrats are saying that are arguing against the war in Iraq. Can you name one of them that has argued against fighting the war on terrorism? But there is no war on terrorism. Can you name one of them who says, "It's bogus. It's nonsense. There's no war on terrorism. We're doing this for the reasons of oil. We're doing this for the reasons of empire. They don't say that. They're not opposed to it for that reason. Mirtha, who wants to station the troops outside of Iraq, doesn't think we ought to be fighting the war on terrorism. He tells you that. He just thinks we're fighting it stupidly by having ourselves bogged down in Iraq. What are we going to do with Iran, Syria, the Sudan, et cetera, if we're all bogged down in this silly war in Iraq? That's not the way to fight the war on terrorism, substitute to advance our interest in the world, to figure out how to control the world. And I find that the fact that speaking out is our best tool not discouraging at all. Because when I think about it, if you do any studying of the history of empires in the world, whether it's the British Empire, the German Empire, go through any of them, they all contained within themselves the seeds of their own destruction. The U.S. Empire, with its hubris, its greed, its reliance on military might as opposed to the wisdom of its ideas, you know, has the seeds of its own destruction in it. But if you look at all of those countries, what slowed down the end of their empire, their empires were slowed down to the extent that they were able to prevent dissent from the plan for empire within their own people. Germany certainly is the most recent example. Even the Soviet Union, finally, if you think about it, lost it in part for that reason, because they could no longer control their own people. If those who want us to be in an endless war on terrorism can't control us, can't frighten us, can't convince us, can't silence us, that to me is our best hope. I think history is on our side. I think we can prevail. And I think the reason we will prevail is because exactly of folks like you and others that will keep speaking, keep marching, and be unafraid as they do so. So let's stop and talk about all of this. Thank you. You, yeah, Jim. I think Jim's point is simply that there are candidates who represent real alternatives to the war makers in Washington, and by backing their campaigns and working on their campaigns, it provides an opportunity to have that voice heard, because in an election year, people are paying attention to the electoral arena. Is that a fair summary of what you're saying? Yeah. By the way, I'm having Marcy Winograd will be on our radio show this Thursday night. She's actually running against Jane Harman. I had invited her and Jane Harman to come on. Jane Harman has not responded. I don't know why, but Marcy will be on. But I wouldn't want anyone to think that that means I endorse that process. I just believe in giving voices to also anybody who's got something good to say, whether the Democrat, Republican, Communist, Atheist, or, you know, whoever. I welcome on my show. So it's got nothing to do with that. But let me say this. First of all, I have very little energy anymore for trying to convince people about the folly of the electoral system in this country. I find I rarely win the argument. I don't seem to be able to convince many people. And so I spend my time trying to do something more useful. Let me just say this. I can't think of any major accomplishment in the civil rights field, civil liberties field, or the question of war and peace that came about because enough good people ran the government of the United States. I can't point to any such period of time when that was true. People have been trying to reform and take back the Democratic Party as long as I've been alive. And it's fine with me, by the way, if they do take it back, I might add. But it doesn't ever add up to enough. I guess the way I put it, it isn't a question of whether there's no difference between the two parties. Sure, there's a difference. The question is that difference between the two parties of sufficient magnitude to change the direction of the country, which at the moment is this way, and make it go this way? If I thought it was, if I saw any evidence of that, that there was a snowball's chance in hell of using the electoral process to send the country in this direction, I wouldn't have the view that I have. I sometimes look at it like there are two boats out on a lake. And one's the Republican Party boat, and one's the Democratic Party boat. And they both got holes in them, right? I will grant you that there are more holes in the Republican Party boat. If you will grant me that if you stay in either one of them very long, you will drown. That's the reality. And we're either going to have to come to grips with that, or I fear we may be lost. As long as we keep chasing that rainbow or that ring around or whatever it is, the merry-go-round that believes that, oh, just I mean, Marcy Winograd is a wonderful person. That's not the issue. I know all of those. Bill Parparian is a friend of mine. That's not the issue. Who did you mention?
Bob
McCloskey, one of the great labor. Not the issue. It isn't the case. It has not been the case. And given the way the electoral system in this country runs, operates, the role of money in it, the role of corporate America, it will not be the case that our salvation can be found in that arena. That's my honest view. And so I think we don't like to admit that, because the alternative is very rough. The alternative isn't so easy as just voting on election day. It means creating new parties, new political formations. It means saying the hell with both of them. And nobody wants to do that. That's hard work. The one thing I will say is this. It's interesting to me to note how many people in this country have intuitively understood it, at least to the extent where they don't bother to vote. Now, you can either draw the conclusion that or people are hopeless idiots, or maybe they know something that those of us that vote don't know. One last thing on this point, and then I'll stop, because I'm on a rant here. In Germany, under Stalin, in Germany, in East Germany, I should say, there was a state in East Germany that at the beginning prided itself on being the state in East Germany that had the highest percentage of people that went to the polls every election day, even though there was really no choice on the ballot. 99% of them went to polls. As they came to understand the lack of any meaningful choice on the ballot, they prided themselves, and the only way they could, on being the state in East Germany that sent the fewest people to vote every year. That was the only way they could really vote. And I would argue that all those people that we criticize that stay home on election day may be telling us something. Yes. Well, it's about half the electorate. It's more than that if you think about who registers and who doesn't. You know, it's kind of like somebody asked me the other day, well, I understand. It's kind of like somebody said to me, we were at a press conference and talking about what we're doing for these students, and somebody said, Mr. Lafferty, do you really believe these students, when they walked out of school, knew what the Sensenbrenner King Bill was all about? And I said, I'll tell you what they knew. They knew that this bill was going to send mom and dad, who had risked their life coming across the damn desert to get to this country to put food on the table and give them something they never had, in jail. And I don't know that you need to know much more about the Sensenbrenner King bill than that if you've got any pride and love for your family to walk out of school. They know enough. They understand they've gotten nothing from going to those polls and casting that ballot. Most people in this country, I think, and that's why there's such disdain for the political system. Yes, ma'am.
Be in the minority here.
I'm sorry.
Okay,
that's okay.
I'm
good.
But for you to sit here and say that we should not participate in this political system, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean you can't also mm-hmm. be doing things to improve things. Mm-hmm. To get those fucking Republicans and not have any of us voting against them, mm-hmm. what are you talking about?
First of all, I'm not telling you to do that.
Well, it's what I hear.
I'm telling you that I don't think it matters.
I think it does.
Well, then you've got to go vote.
And to tell me, well, but look at all these minorities who don't vote. They're the ones who aren't voting.
Yeah, but why don't they vote? Are they stupid?
Because they don't, they're not
Are they stupid?
Well,
that sounds like you're, that sounds a little effete to me. Yes, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. The characteristics of their voting patterns, if we had gotten more of them, or if we got them more of them today.
I agree with you. Yes.
So I just want to make sure.
No, that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I hear him saying that's not.
No, I'm saying, no, it isn't. It's not that it's not significant, it's that it doesn't. Look, if Kerry had been elected, would we be out of Iraq today? Or would we have the 40,000 more troops than that he wanted to send?
How do you know?
I only know what he told me. How do you know? He said to me, if I'm elected president, I...
change his mind.
Well, that's true. And what will make him change his mind is the same thing that made Nixon and Ford change their minds. You and I. And it doesn't matter whether we voted for Nixon or Ford or not. That's the only problem I make. I'm not saying don't vote, but one thing I would encourage us to do is to start thinking about third parties, parties that aren't tied in to the corporate America. I think that might be... because the money that elects both of those parties doesn't want what you and I want for this country. And they aren't going to change their mind because they don't have the same interest we do. The people that run this country aren't the people who can't afford the abortions or can't get a good education or can't afford the house. Those people don't run the country. Never had, as far as I can tell, but certainly don't today, and neither one of those parties offers them the chance to run the country. It's like saying, I don't know, anyway, but I mean, so I understand why you're frustrated, because you think, gee whiz, if everybody just voted for the right person. But, you know, it's kind of like people said about Kucinich. The problem with Kucinich was, it wasn't a question of whether he was a good person or not. He couldn't have gotten elected in a billion years in this country. The system is rigged. It isn't going to happen. And as long as we think it's going to happen, we're fooling ourselves. That's all I'm trying to say. Yes, in the back. What she's saying is there's this sense that we're in for decades of war. This war on terror is a permanent war. It's a holy war, for one thing, and holy wars tend to go on forever, right? It's a war on terrorism. Who signs the peace treaty with us? If Osama bin Laden said, okay, I give up, would that end the war? Of course not. So it's an endless war, as long as we believe it's a war. The question then is, well, what about finances? Can we really afford that? I think that's a fair question. But I think the folks who run this country see this as kind of the end game. There is only so much oil left. Everybody wants it. People who could have put up a good fight with us before for it can't fight us as well for it today. So let's get what we can before we can't get any more of it. And if that means squashing a few countries or invading a few places, what the hell, you know? We're desperate. Will the money, I think it'll eventually come back financially, but I don't know when. I mean, you have a prediction on that? Yes, and then the gentleman behind you. The civil disobedience has a role too, of course, and all of that. I guess the only thing I'm saying is that my view at the moment is, and we don't have a lot of time left, is that if we waste it believing that we can solve the problems in the old way, we're lost. So let's try to do that which has had some success in the past. I mentioned the various social movements, that they often worked with the electoral arena too, but I believe their success was owed to the fact that they remained independent, nonpartisan from those electoral movements. I think the labor movement, for example, got into trouble when it became simply an adjunct of the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party became simply another capitalist party. I mean, to the extent that that happens, I think people get co-opted, and it's easy to get co-opted. To the extent that the civil rights movement, under King and Malcolm for that matter and others, stayed independent of that process to a certain extent, it achieved great victories in the Congress without electing anybody different to the Congress. That was my point about Vietnam. Without changing the makeup of who was in the White House or the Congress, we ended the war finally in Vietnam. We can do the same with Iraq. The example that our immigrant sisters and brothers just gave us, I think, is an amazing example. Here's this tidal wave of anger about immigrants. And everybody's railed up, we're going to arm the borders, we're going to build 700-mile fences, by God, and it's on a roll in a Republican Congress, and a Republican Senate, a Republican House, and a Republican administration, and what happens? A million people take to the streets, and next thing you know, the bill isn't on the table anymore. And they're scratching their heads trying to come up with some piece of crap bill that will buy them off. And some people are being bought off. Some people said, well, McCain, Kennedy's not too bad. Oh, it's a piece of crap. But that's the latest strategy. Don't get bought off. Say the hell with it. There's 11 million of us in this country. We've been helping prop up this country for all these years. What are you going to do, round up and send us home? They marched. Were you there? How many people were there? It was the most amazing thing. I've only been at a demonstration like that once in my life, and that was in 1982 at the Central Park, the nuclear demonstration in Central Park. And this one had a much different feel about it than this is the future of America that was marching in the streets. I take hope from that. I will be disappointed if they all get as the Cardinal and some of the rest and some of the labor unions, frankly, would like to pull them in now to just, I loved it. The one big vigil that they had downtown said, today we march, tomorrow we vote. No, you don't vote tomorrow. You're not even a citizen in this country. Why the hell are you telling these people that tomorrow they vote? They can't vote. Legalization is what you want to keep talking about. That's why a million people marched. That's why all the stores on Broadway were shut downtown, as well as all the other stores downtown on May 1st. It had nothing to do with some crappy Bracero program or anything like it. It's when you get sucked into what is safe and calm and can be directed, and now we'll compromise, we'll win a little here, we'll give a little there. Too late for that. So to the extent that I have a strategy, it's encourage third-party formations, encourage party formations that really are parties of workers and people that aren't beholden to the corporations, and in the meanwhile, spend your energies trying to hold the tidal wave of repression away, try to stop the march towards world domination, which is making us enemies all over the world, so that when we travel to some other country, I don't have to wear my Bush button with an X through it, so I don't get spray painted in the subways of some place or other, right? I mean, that's not a fast, hard blueprint. In other words, erode the power of the elite. Resist them, stay away from it. Yes, and now we're going to get a... How do we resist? Yes, it means masses of people in the streets. It means refusing to be cowed. It means going to jail sometimes for your beliefs, as we did in the Civil Rights Movement and the anti-war movement. There may be more of that ahead. Yeah, absolutely. Well, wait a minute, I had promised the gentleman over there they would try to crush us with anything they had at their disposal. You say optimistic. I say it's our only hope. I don't know if I'm optimistic or not. I'm just not prepared to die a slow death with ways that I know don't work. I'd rather go out, you know, at least giving it my all and not pretending that I think I can change the world on November 2nd when I know I can't. Because yes, I think push has come to shove. Hey, global warming alone may decide the whole thing for us anyway. Another 30, 40, 50 years, right? You sure? But do you really think? Yeah, but the people that run this country or that run most of the Western democracies, they're doing better than we are overseas, but they don't want to do it. This, by the way, is Bob McCloskey. Yeah, well, you were out campaigning, when you got here, you'd missed when I kind of addressed that earlier. What I said very quickly, Bob, was that the Patriot Act and all of that that followed 9/11 was simply to put cover on what the administration wanted to do in terms of its overseas exploits for controlling the world and to keep a lid on dissent here at home on any issues, domestic or foreign. The natural fear that came from being attacked by these strange-looking foreigners was played up to the hilt. That's why we rounded up tens of thousands of Muslims and all the rest. So the Patriot Act, it doesn't make us safer. It's not designed to make us safer. It's designed, as I said earlier, to protect the ruling elite in this country from us. It gives them a way to clamp down on us, to take away our right to... You know, just right after 9/11, and Bob, I think, probably knows this, there were a number of times, one of the things I do is I secure permits for marches. And L.A. is probably the only major city left in the country today. Let me just jump to the end of this. The only city left in the major city left in the country today, where if the president shows up at a hotel or somewhere, we can demonstrate by that hotel. You can't get anywhere near the president otherwise in this country. For a variety of reasons, we've won that victory here in L.A. But it's all about protecting them from us. And that's Schiff's role too. Or he's just a coward because, hey, we are attacked. Only 6 or 8 of the members of Congress had read the Patriot Act before they voted for it. It said Patriot Act. What am I going to do? Vote against it? For Christ's sakes, I'll be voted out of office. Do a public opinion poll in this country. If you ask people about the various provisions of the Patriot Act, 80% of them will disagree with every main provision of the Patriot Act. But if you just go to them and say, do you support or not the Patriot Act, 80% say, of course.
Thank you.
This was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can visit us on the web at lasoundposse.org.